From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're broadcasting today and tomorrow from NPR in Washington, D.C. President Trump is in New York, holding meetings at Trump Tower, where protesters are positioned, angry about the 2 days it took for him to condemn the white supremacists and Nazis and violence that led to a woman's death in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the weekend. Last night, two more CEOs joined the one who'd quit the President's Manufacturing Council. In a tweet this morning, President Trump called them grandstanders who can be easily replaced. And then later this morning, another Scott Paul, head of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, tweeted that he was resigning because it's the right thing for me to do. Let's bring in Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Nice to see you here in Washington, Domenico.
Hey there. Great to have you here.
And lots of exits, though, that we are seeing today.
Yeah, you know, it's funny to me because when you think about how this president ran, he likes to talk about how he's a businessman and that you need a businessman who can run the country, and ran against what he saw as political correctness. But, you know, a lot of these businesses in corporate America don't want to get involved in controversy. Donald Trump's never shied away from that, but they realize that that political correctness is actually good for business.
Well, he did, the president, call out the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists in that statement at the White House. But on the CBS Late Show last night, host Stephen Colbert asked Trump's former communications director, Anthony Scaramucci, who, of course, left in kind of a scandalous cloud, why it took his former boss 2 days to call out the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis. Here's what he said.
It's almost like a counterintuitive thing with him as it relates to the media. The media is expecting him to do something. He sometimes does the exact opposite.
Wait, just to thumb his nose at them?
Wait a second.
You're saying that he does something to do the opposite of what's expected of him?
Some of that worked during the campaign.
Yeah. He also said Scaramucci said it was the wrong thing to do. Yeah. Are we getting the sense that even from outside, people are sending him flares? You're not listening to the right people? Or
I mean, I think there's a difference between what good professional policy communication strategy are versus what Donald Trump's instincts are. You know, he often, when he's attacked, he wants to attack back. So if he feels like that he's been put under the microscope for or blamed in some way for what's happened in mm-hmm. Charlotte, where there is this undercurrent because of the kind of campaign that Donald Trump ran, that a lot of people are looking at him for either leadership to knock this down, to separate himself. And it's absolutely true that he's been very strongly against any kind of group that let's just put it this way. He's never been shy about taking shots at people and things that he thinks are wrong or doesn't like, but in this case, wasn't as strong up front.
Well, in the meantime, there is real important news going on. There's, of course, what happened in Charlottesville and the reaction to that and what people think might be happening going forward. And then we're hearing this morning the Iranian president is hinting that he might want to try to get around the nuclear deal. Meanwhile, we're also hearing that North Korea seems to be quieting down on its posturing on using nuclear weapons. Everything else is being obscured.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the president's also supposed to speak this afternoon, and he could take questions. We'll wait and see if he actually does that. But normally, a White House would want to avoid this kind of drama and chaos because you'd want to push in a very strategic way whatever the president's message is, whether that's policy or some rollout of an initiative, or just to deal with the myriad of complexities around the world, be it North Korea or now this other piece with Iran. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, and we are expecting to hear from the president. He is expected to talk about the economy. He might take questions, so we might be hearing more. But what else do you see from your look at the political prism we might be seeing? There are reports today that it's Rupert Murdoch that's actually pressuring to have Steve Bannon, who, of course, ran the far-right extremist platform Breitbart News, who's been whispering in President Trump's ear that it's Rupert Murdoch that's saying he should go.
Well, he's one of the people, that's for sure. But, you know, that might not be that all that surprising, to be honest. Fox versus Breitbart has been a little bit of a, you know, internecine conservative war because Breitbart has been looking to up its stature and has done so, and at the expense in some regards of Fox News, because Fox News had been the only thing that conservatives, or the main principal thing that conservatives could look to No one would have thought that Donald Trump or anybody else could have taken on Fox News, and he did so during the campaign and then brought on Steve Bannon, emboldening that wing of the conservative base.
And some would say emboldening the white supremacists and Nazis that we saw in Charlottesville. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor with us here in Washington. Domenico, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in the wake of what happened in Charlottesville, many cities are thinking about what to do with their Confederate monuments. A nearly century-old Confederate statue was toppled by protesters late yesterday in Durham, North Carolina. Police took video throughout the protest but didn't intervene as demonstrators climbed a ladder, attached a rope, and then pulled down the statue. We're going to hear from two other southern cities now dealing with this issue, starting with Josh James of Station WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky.
Today, Mayor Jim Gray is asking the city council to begin the process of moving two Confederate-era statues from the heart of Lexington. After the clashes between white nationalists and counter-protesters in Charlottesville, Gray said it was time for them to go.
Relocating these statues and explaining them is the right thing to do. And that's why I've recommended to our city council that they be placed along our Veterans Park War Memorial Walk, together with two monuments to the Union effort. In that setting, we can tell the story accurately and share a truthful history.
The action marks the first real movement in years in a long, simmering community debate over what to do with the two prominent downtown memorials to Confederate generals John Hunt Morgan and John C. Breckinridge near Cheapside Park. Alice Turkington said she backs Gray's decision.
I think on Cheapside right here, this is, as I understand it, this used to be a place where slaves were sold. And I think that it's not appropriate to have these Confederate monuments here.
William Carey took a different view.
You know, it's part of U.S. history that you should not erase. Knowing if you erase it, it never exists, and future people will repeat the past when they don't learn.
City leaders have been under pressure to address the issue since 2015, when someone scrawled Black Lives Matter in black paint on the Hunt Morgan statue. Now, the mayor's announcement puts the momentum behind removal. But proponents say the real debate is only just beginning.
Well, there's a lot of fight for that space and the fight to get that information out and to make sure that this goes through that we're just now gearing up for.
Russell Allen is with a group called Take Back Cheapside, which has been trying to bring awareness to the history of the statues and nearby park.
But we're going to take that energy and we're going to try to turn that into something positive for our city and make sure that we don't end up in similar circumstances.
But moving the statues will require the okay from a state military commission, which doesn't meet until November. Mayor Gray wants to expedite the process and win approval by next month. If successful, the move could have ripple effects, reviving dormant efforts to remove Confederate symbols and memorials across the Commonwealth, including a likeness of Confederate President Jefferson Davis in the state capitol. For Here and Now, I'm Josh James in Lexington, Kentucky.
Well, meanwhile, at the state capitol in Tennessee yesterday, dozens of protesters gathered to demand the immediate removal of a bust of Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest. Chaz Sisk from Here and Now contributor WPLN in Nashville has that story.
Elizabeth Tissell lives in a remote part of Tennessee, about an hour south of the state capitol. She is white and says she was appalled by the footage of white men and women brawling in the streets of Charlottesville. But she believes those white supremacists have far more support than some might think.
This is not a fringe group. These people are my neighbors.
Come on.
They're friendly to me, they're nice to me, and they give me dirty looks at my car because I've got bumper stickers on my car. I know what they're really thinking.
That's why Tissell is joining efforts to take down one of the most controversial symbols of the Confederacy in Nashville. Nathan Bedford Forrest was a slave trader, a feared cavalryman, and a founder of the Ku Klux Klan. Many hold him responsible for the massacre of 300 African-American troops at a Union fort in 1864. Nashville activist Justin Jones has tried for years to get Forrest's likeness removed from the state capitol. He says it's an affront to people of color.
That symbol serves as a daily reminder that they're not welcome here in the people's house.
But there have been many calls to remove the bust since it went up in the 1970s. The most recent came after the Charleston church shooting 2 years ago, and that campaign triggered a law that actually makes it harder to remove Confederate monuments across the state. The problem, says Jones, is white Tennesseans. Even those who oppose Confederate monuments haven't been involved enough.
What we need our white brothers and sisters to do is to put their bodies on the line.
White violence is violence! White violence is violence!
In the nearly two-hour protest, whites were at the forefront, kneeling in protest outside Republican Governor Bill Haslam's office in the Tennessee Capitol. The message that whites specifically are responsible for racism seemed to make Ron Clarity of Nashville uncomfortable.
It's beautiful to see people come together, but people get so ruffled in their feelings about things that don't even matter. It's a statue inside a building.
Clarity says he'd like to see the statue come down too, but believes opponents of racism should focus on building unity. Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam wasn't in the Capitol during the protest, and he lacks the authority to take the statue down on his own. But through an aide, he promised to push the state commissions and lawmakers who control the Capitol complex to act. For Here and Now, I'm Chaz Sisk in Nashville.
There have been five mass extinction events in the history of the Earth, the most famous being the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. But the Permian mass extinction was even more deadly. 96% of the life on Earth died. Peter Brannan looks back on that history in his new book, The Ends of the World: Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. Brannan is a science journalist who's looking back in order to look forward at the danger the Earth may be in today. Peter Brannan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So it seems like when you look at all of these mass extinctions in the history of the Earth, that they all involve some kind of climate change that has to do with carbon emissions in the atmosphere.
Well, yeah, I think there's been, at least in the popular imagination, there's this understanding that mass extinctions are what happens when asteroids hit the planet. And I think there's been this really cool story over the past few decades from the paleontology and geology community where they've looked for evidence of asteroid impacts at all the mass extinction levels. And except for the one that we know about when the dinosaurs go extinct, all the mass extinctions seem to have a lot to do with these giant ocean and climate changes that are driven by carbon dioxide. So, you know, in the first mass extinction a long time ago, it seems like there was an ice age from falling CO2. And then in some of the other mass extinctions, it seems like there's extreme global warming and ocean acidification and some of the same stuff we see going on today, driven by carbon dioxide.
And in the past, that carbon dioxide is coming not from cars and factories, but from volcanoes.
Right. So as one paleontologist put it to me, it doesn't matter whether carbon dioxide comes from Volvos or volcanoes. The atmosphere and the ocean responds the same way. But yeah, these are really extreme volcanic events. They're called continental flood basalts. But what happens is basically the Earth kind of opens up in some part of the world, and you just have these floods of lava for thousands of years. But the lava isn't what's killing most of life on Earth because it only covers a certain area. But you see stuff going extinct all over the planet. And it's actually thought that the gases that come up with these volcanoes, most notably CO2, is what's driving the mass extinction. So that's something we is kind of alarming, I guess.
When we talk about a mass extinction, does that mean everything on Earth dies?
The mass extinctions are really five times where over 75% of complex life goes extinct in what geologically is a really quick period of time. So tens of thousands of years at the most, and maybe much quicker than that.
One of the things you point out in this book is that a warning sign for a mass extinction involves the coral reefs being in trouble in the oceans. Tell us about that. When has that happened in the past? Because it is something that is starting to happen now.
Right, yeah. So that's definitely one of the more alarming things is that there have really only been these things called reef collapses a few times in the entire history of animal life. And, you know, oftentimes they're associated with these mass extinctions. So there's this time, the end Triassic mass extinction, where 75% of life went extinct. And coral reefs had this amazing sort of blossoming in the end of the Triassic. And then, you know, they make up a lot of the Austrian Alps. If you hike up those mountains, you can kind of see that they're just made of coral reefs.
Really?
Yeah. And at the end of the Triassic, coral reefs basically disappear completely for millions of years. Too much CO2, when it reacts with seawater, it makes the water more acidic, it makes it warmer, and it makes it really difficult for things like coral reefs to stick around. And so when we plot out what humans are doing for the next few decades, coral reefs are really going to have a hard time sticking around in the second half of this century. And given that that's only happened a few times in Earth's history, that's really pretty amazing that humans have that influence.
And we're already seeing that in places like the Great Barrier Reef right now as ocean temperatures rise just a little bit.
Right. So the Great Barrier Reef has had this really dramatic die-off in only the past year, actually. There was a really bad episode of it. And that's from warming. So modern coral reefs also don't like when it gets warm. But then when you make the water more acidic, too, that's just another stress. And so when we look at what that's going to look like by 2050, unless we get our emissions under control, this is really just a glimpse of the future, unfortunately.
When we look back at the past mass extinctions, do they happen quickly or do they take hundreds, thousands, millions of years to take place?
Yeah, so I think this is kind of an urgent question to address because it's hard to sort of see with high resolution in the fossil record things that happened hundreds of millions of years ago. So maybe these are good analogs for the near future, or maybe these things really do take thousands of years. I think that's something we're trying to figure out. You know, some people would tell you that the dinosaurs were wiped out in 15 minutes in a really bad day, and other people would say that it was sort of this more prolonged thing where ecosystems were stressed by a lot of things, and then the asteroid and these crazy volcanoes in India. It might have been a more prolonged episode that lasted thousands of years. So I think we need to get a better handle of how quickly these things can happen.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Peter Brannon, whose book is called The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. Peter Brannon, in order to do the research for this book, you went all over the country to places that many people don't realize are historical artifacts of what happened in some of these mass extinctions.
Right. So, I mean, for example, one place I went was Cincinnati, which apparently is one of the most fossil-rich regions in the entire world. Just if you pull over on the side of the highway, there's this sort of gray-layered rock that if you go up to it, it's filled with just sea life. Seashells are falling out of the side of the highway in Cincinnati. And this is from 445 million years ago when North America was sort of rotated on its side and south of the equator for the most part, and there was no life on land, and there are all these weird sort of horseshoe crab-looking things in the ocean. So it's this totally different world that exists just on the side of the highway. Another place is the Palisades in New York, which are these giant cliffs made out of basalt that I'd seen a million times visiting New York, but I had no idea that they were part of this sort of magma from one of the worst mass extinctions ever. And you can find the same rock in Nova Scotia and Brazil and Spain. And it's one of these sort of crazy, almost global volcanic events that almost ended life on Earth. So yeah, I mean, there are these mundane places. You've seen them a million times. But the story of geology is really that we're standing on this, you know, underneath our feet are these totally different worlds that once you see through the sort of lens of geology, kind of changes your perspective on everything.
Well, and now today we think of the Appalachian Mountains as the smaller mountain range
right.
in the United States. But you write that back in the day, they would have been as tall as the Alps.
Oh, yeah. They would have been these towering snow-covered peaks that would have stretched from, I don't know, Greenland to Alabama. So they are this epic mountain chain, and they just have the misfortune of having been around for a long time. So they've been eroded away. But yeah, they're not just the sort of hills we see, but the months were much more grand than that.
All right. So now let's get back to the catastrophe at hand,
sure.
which is how close are we now to something like what has happened in the past? We know that we are producing a lot of carbon into the atmosphere.
Yeah. So far, the damage humans have caused in the environment hasn't actually been through climate change or ocean acidification I was talking about before, but it's actually been through direct interaction with the environment, hunting, fishing, habitat destruction, deforestation, that sort of thing.
Basically, any time that humans in history have shown up in a place, a lot of other species end up dying pretty quickly.
Right, yeah. So if you plot whenever, certainly in the Pacific Islands in the last few hundred years, all these local bird species and things go extinct when humans show up. And in Australia and in North America, it seems like there's this pretty solid coincidence in time between when humans first show up, when all these giant sort of ice age animals go extinct. And then up to the present day, when we're really sort of now with industrial fishing trawlers and things like that, we're sort of accelerating our influence on the environment. But the good news is that there's a lot of biodiversity still to save. Certainly, we've had an incredibly destructive influence on the environment, but I think typical estimates for how many species we've driven extinct is documented less than 1%. Maybe it's a few percent at the most. And these mass extinctions we're talking about, upwards of 75%, sometimes 90% of species go extinct. So we're not there yet, which is the good news, but we really only have a few decades to sort of right the ship because we see that populations in animals are declining all over the world and range sizes are sort of contracting. And that's sort of the first indicator that a species might be about to go extinct is big population decline. So if you project that forward a few centuries, then we might actually be in the same conversation is these crazy events that really only happen once every 100 million years or so.
And what about on the issue of carbon emissions? How close are we to trouble there?
So we know that sometimes you hear a sort of climate denier people say, oh, it's been warm in Earth's past. and life was happy, which is true. But the problem is for life that when you change things really quickly, sometimes it can't respond in time. And certainly when you have society with buildings and highways, if life needs to migrate, if it gets really warm, we might be blocking those migration routes. And so maybe we're making it much more difficult for animals and plants to adapt if climate does change really dramatically.
I have to say, after reading this book, that I wonder if there's much that we can do, or if these things are just so much bigger than what humans can do to fix the problems.
Yeah, so certainly we need to transform our energy system in the next decade or two. There's an incredible challenge that there's reason to be skeptical whether humans can do that. But there's other steps we can take. We know that if you just let life sort of have a chance to bounce back, it's incredibly resilient. So a couple decades ago, you weren't supposed to eat swordfish because we almost fished it to extinction. And now we let swordfish rebound and their stocks are healthy again. And there is a movement towards setting aside more of nature for protected areas. George W. Bush notably set aside the biggest marine protected area at the time. So it shouldn't be a political issue. It hasn't always been a political issue. And I think it's a shame that environmentalism and stewardship of the planet has become one. And hopefully we can move away from that.
Can we avoid another mass extinction?
I think we can. Unless we just stick our head in the sand and do things exactly the same way we've been doing it for the last 50 to 100 years, I think we can. In my better moods, I'm hopeful about humanity's ability to learn and adapt to the changing world around them.
That's Peter Brannon, whose book is called The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Next week's total solar eclipse might be the most studied disappearance of the sun ever. That's thanks in part to legions of citizen scientists. NASA and other institutions are recruiting volunteers to aid science experiments tied to the eclipse. In some cases, all you need to join the crowdsourced observing network is a smartphone. Tom Bonsi from the Northwest News Network reports.
On the morning of the total eclipse, retired science teacher Bruce Montgomery plans to park his pickup truck in his brother-in-law's hayfield near Prineville, Oregon, while his extended family peers skyward with those funny eclipse viewing glasses. Montgomery will keep one eye on his portable ham radio.
Whiskey Alpha 7, Bravo Alpha Mike, needing a call back.
Montgomery is one of many amateur radio operators volunteering in a citizen science project to examine the ionosphere. Long-distance radio signals bounce off that layer of the upper atmosphere, which is influenced by solar radiation. Montgomery will transmit voice and data calls before, during, and after the eclipse. Automated receivers across the continent will measure how the moon's passage in front of the sun affects how far radio signals carry.
Yeah, I get excited about it. It's going to be good fun to participate in genuine scientific research and contributing to this body of knowledge, even though I can assure you that my small station will be a very small contribution.
The ham radio experiment is just one of many avenues for non-scientists to take part in eclipse studies. Rihanna Mungin is a senior engineering student at Portland State University. She joined a student team that will deploy camera-carrying high-altitude weather balloons. They'll launch from Corvallis in western Oregon.
This balloon, we want it to go to at least 80,000 feet.
Dang, that's pretty.
Yeah.
I mean, that's way above where airplanes fly.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, airplanes, you know, maximum they're going about 39,000 feet. So we're going at least twice as high.
Theirs is one of more than 50 NASA-funded balloons which will live stream the eclipse from its beginning off the Oregon coast, then follow it cross-country to South Carolina and out into the Atlantic. Mungin's team flight tested 3 additional balloons they plan to send to the edge of space to photograph the shadow of the moon as it races across Oregon.
You're going to be wherever you are during the eclipse. The sun's going to get blocked out. You'll be in total darkness, and then it'll come back up. But there's no context, right, for what's happening. You don't really see what's going on. So this is a way that it'll help change that perspective.
Slots in the Eclipse Ballooning Collaboration are all taken, but there are other citizen science projects with unlimited capacity. A NASA video invites anyone with a smartphone and an outdoor thermometer to download an app and participate in a study about how much the temperature drops.
In the path of the eclipse, temperatures and clouds can change quickly. But exactly how they change is a question NASA scientists are trying to answer. If you'll be in North America during the August 21st eclipse, you can help NASA collect data for us.
Another smartphone-based experiment run by the California Academy of Sciences invites you to choose nearby plants or animals to observe immediately before and after the eclipse and report any behavioral changes you see. Eclipse photographers can upload pictures of the total solar eclipse with location coordinates. The University of California, Berkeley, and Google will stitch those images together into what they're calling a crowdsourced eclipse mega movie. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi in Portland, Oregon.
Are you an elder orphan? Yeah, they're also called unbefriended adults, yikes. Or in healthcare, patients without surrogates. They are people aging alone without kids. They now have a Facebook group with about 5,000 users in just 1 year who are 55 or over, live without a spouse, and either don't have children or are estranged from them. A 2015 AARP report concluded there are far fewer family caregivers for people over 80 than ever, and it's going to get worse. The number of women who reach 50 with no children has doubled since the 1980s, from 10% to up to about 20%. So, what to do? Well, Carol Marak of Dallas, Texas, is a columnist and editor at SeniorCare.com, and she started the Facebook group for elder orphans. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
So, elder orphans. I understand that you, after taking care of both of your parents, started to look at your horizon and think, hey, wait a minute, I might be one of these people?
Exactly. Kind of hit me over the head. It was like, oh my gosh, my parents demanded quite a bit of care. And my sisters and I provided that for them. And once they passed on, I realized, oh my goodness, all that time, effort, and resources it took from us, who will do that for me?
Right. Well, and so as part of trying to answer this question, you've come up with this Facebook group. What are you hearing?
Well, first off, most of the members are very grateful to have found us and realize that there are so many more like them. And we all share the same grievances, the same hardships and challenges. And so we all visit it most of the time, every day, just checking in. We give support to people who are going into surgery or who've had an emergency or some sort of a medical event. And I cannot tell you, Robin, how supportive that feels for the people who are going through an incident like that.
I was reading some of the comments that you shared on the Huffington Post of just what the things that people say. And they literally could say, hey, I'm going in. Keep a good thought for me.
Yes.
Because there's no children to do that. That's who usually takes care of you.
Absolutely. And what's remarkable, just recently, one of my members here that lives in Dallas, she just had hip surgery. And, you know, she didn't have any visitors. I mean, a friend or two stopped by, but no one to check on her at home, except her brother, who occasionally did that. So it is a growing problem.
Well, also a problem because doesn't the healthcare system assume that you will have a family member who will be able to bring you to the hospital for a procedure or take you home after a colonoscopy? You have to have somebody drive you home, and not everybody
That's right.
has that family member.
That's what happened to this one individual here in Dallas. She couldn't find someone. As a matter of fact, when she was preparing for the surgery and she was talking with her physician's office, they didn't even ask, do you have someone who can help you at home?
Well, you and others not only have a sympathetic ear, You also give advice on what you think that these, you know, elder orphans, people without children to take care of them in their older years, what they might do to start thinking about it, well, at the age you're at. Do I understand you're in your mid-60s?
That's correct.
Right. And start thinking about what? About where you might live?
Absolutely. And that's just what happened to me just recently. I moved from suburbia into a highly urban area where there is metro, you know, transportation, buses, public transit. I'm also very healthy, fortunately, but I do walk. I run my errands via foot, so I kind of kill two birds with one stone there, stay fit and run errands. And I live in a high rise, you know, because I want to surround myself with other people. I don't want to live in a home isolated. So we have to think about those things. How do we plan for aging alone?
So some of the questions you ask people to ask, do you know your neighbors? Do you have a sense of community? There's a story in USA Today about a woman who's 59, was considering already her future as an elder orphan. She called herself that, moved to Panama and found more community there than she had in Denver. In 22 years in Denver, she said she didn't know her neighbors. She found a community in Panama of like-minded elder orphans living together, helping each other.
That's pretty phenomenal.
Well, it's what you're saying, you know, look for that social network. How else do you recommend people find a social network? As you get older, it's harder to make friends.
I would suggest, first off, just reaching out to the local area agencies on aging. Then I would also reach out to senior centers. Just go where seniors hang out.
Well, and do I understand you're considering something that sounds pretty creative but unusual? Maybe you, the elder orphan, will adopt a family?
Yeah, yes, ma'am. That's
how would that work?
Well, I mean, think about it. I mean, how many families are maybe without an older individual? Or maybe they've lost their parents or they've lost their grandmother. Of course, it requires a lot of forethought and even some help with legal matters, but I think it's an option.
Well, and I can hear someone saying, oh, you know, elder care, you know, because that's your point, that when you do need that family to take care of you, you know, decades down the road, they'd be there. It's a huge endeavor, but what you are offering is that in exchange for, you know, you adopting a family and they taking care of you down the road, you would actually leave them your assets?
Absolutely.
Huh.
Yes.
Wow. So again, that's going to take a lot of planning and a lawyer. But meantime, you also talk about something that a lot of people are doing, which is elder orphans gathering together in a living situation.
Mm-hmm. It's happening a lot. Let's say, for example, I have a large home in suburbia, for example. I can either rent out a bedroom to a college student, for example, mm-hmm. and in return, maybe not charge them rent, but maybe in return that they would run errands for me. I could even rent out a room to another person my own age.
And you also say elder orphans can pool resources, live in the same house, but have a bedroom for a live-in caretaker that they all could benefit from.
Yes, that's happening in the co-housing communities where it's intentional communities that are being built with everyone having their own homes potentially or maybe a high-rise and they have their own spaces. But they do provide a separate space for a caregiver free of charge.
Yeah.
So that caregiver can then take care of them.
Well, mm-hmm. and they can also remind each other of what else to think about, the things that, you know, maybe adult children are calling their parents and nudging them about. Do you have a health proxy? Have you thought about, you know, a will?
Absolutely. Make sure that you know that you stay fit and eat healthy foods, that you do not isolate, that you do have companionship, that you reach out to the community and possibly volunteer to help another person have purpose in your life.
Hmm. You know? And maybe have better resources if they're pooled, because we're also looking at the 2016 Elder Economic Security Standard Index. This is developed by the Gerontology Institute at UMass Boston. It says more than half American adults living alone can't pay for basic necessities.
Hmm.
So they can maybe help each other.
Well, that's right.
Do you hear about this on Facebook?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, we have so many members who have financial struggles. Prescription medications are so expensive. So, yes, they're struggling financially.
Well, Carol Marek, again, you created the Elder Orphan Facebook group. Just tell us a few more of the things that people are talking about there.
Mostly just sharing what they're feeling each day. We discuss transportation options, emotional, you know, things that might be affecting us. You know, how are we feeling about not having children? Although most of us are grateful not to have children because we have members who have been really, they're estranged from their families, which is hard. So it's just a great place to come and feel accepted and to find friendship and connection.
That's interesting. Accepted if you have regrets about not having children or if you don't.
Absolutely. And what's so wonderful is that when you start a discussion, you're always going to have someone participate. And then you can also pull it offline if you wish and private message someone and then take it from there. Many of us are breaking off and starting our own face-to-face groups, which is really, I think, the next step for all of us.
Carol Marek, she started the Facebook group for so-called elder orphans, people aging without children. She's a columnist and editor at SeniorCare.com. Carol, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
So, would you adopt a family to care for you for maybe 3 decades? I mean, that's a real commitment. And in exchange, leave them your assets. I never heard of that. Your thoughts. Welcome, hereandnow.org.
Tech companies are becoming part of the story of the reaction to Charlottesville and how the president has responded. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is senior editor covering social media for Recode. He joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Kurt.
Hello.
And I want to start with how some tech companies are handling the issue of white supremacy. Google has declined to register a domain for the Daily Stormer, a neo-Nazi website. That group was already kicked off the web hosting domain GoDaddy. Tell us about what's going on there.
Yeah, so following the protests over the weekend, the Daily Stormer, which is a as you mentioned, a neo-Nazi website, started running these really grotesque stories about Heather Heyer, who was the woman who died when the car rammed into the protesters. And so GoDaddy took a stand and said, hey, this violates our terms of service. We think that an article like this could elicit more violence. So we're going to, you know, basically boot your domain off of our hosting platform. And they tried to resubmit that domain with Google's hosting technology. Google said the same thing. And so now the website is kind of basically seeking a home on the internet. And obviously technology companies are saying they don't want to host that kind of content.
And is that decision something that's made by committee at Google, or does somebody right at the top decide, you know, we're going to individually look at this website and say we're not going to host that domain?
I think I'm not exactly sure who made that decision. I would imagine that's a decision that's made at a pretty high level. Mm-hmm. You know, there are going to be a lot of people who push back and say, this is a freedom of speech issue. You know, the Daily Stormer, you may not believe or agree with what they say, but they have a right to say it. The internet has always kind of operated in that way. So for a tech company to come out and basically say, hey, we feel that this type of language, this type of material is actually a danger to people, and that's why we're not going to allow it on here, to me seems like a pretty big stand.
Yesterday, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg released a statement on the events in Charlottesville saying every generation has to be vigilant in fighting against the type of bigotry and hatred that was displayed by the white supremacists in Charlottesville. You reported, though, that Facebook and Twitter aren't making any official changes to their terms of service. Why not?
Well, I think this is a really interesting kind of dynamic right here that a lot of these tech companies are facing, which is that they're oftentimes run by people who clearly disagree with, you know, this white supremacist behavior. They certainly don't condone it. And yet their products and platforms are being weaponized and used to either, you know, rally people around a certain ideology or to, you know, even in this case, there was an event page for this rally on Facebook for up to a month before it actually happened. So they're using Facebook to actually plan these events. So I think what the companies are doing is they're very, very afraid of kind of overstepping this freedom of speech line and saying, here's what is that we as a company allow versus, you know, what we do not. So they try very hard to let everything exist on Facebook, even if it doesn't necessarily align with the personal beliefs of the top executives. But I can only imagine, you know, the internal struggle that these folks see when the product they build every day is being used in ways that they morally don't agree with.
Meanwhile, Kurt, we have three CEOs and now the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, Scott Paul, resigning from the president's Manufacturing Advisory Council. One of the CEOs who left that council comes from the tech industry, the Intel CEO, Brian Krzanich. This isn't the first time that a Silicon Valley CEO has left the council, though, because Elon Musk left a few months ago over the president's decision to leave the Paris Agreement. What does this say about how the tech community feels about President Trump at this point?
Well, I think it's a clear sign that people in the tech world are, you know, they're throwing in the towel in terms of thinking that there's some kind of middle ground here where everybody's going to get on the same page, right? I mean, there was obviously a lot of backlash when someone like Elon Musk first started advising President Trump. They were saying, hey, he doesn't represent the ideals of the broader tech community. What are you doing? But there was a hope, I think, by someone like Elon to say, well, if I'm in the room, you know, maybe there's an arrangement that we can make where everyone kind of comes together and actually accomplishes something. But the fact that they're willing to step back from even an advisory role just goes to show that he's officially kind of crossed this line. And it took a while, and I think for a lot of people it took too long, but he's officially crossed this line to where folks in the tech world are saying, we don't even think that being in the same room with you is helpful or efficient at this point. We're going to go ahead and step back.
One more thing I want to ask you about in the 30 seconds or so that we have left. We're seeing that Twitter users are posting pictures of people who were involved with the Charlottesville rally, asking people to reveal their identities, maybe get them fired or have other negative backlash. What's Twitter saying about that?
So right now, nothing has really happened. It seems like a very questionable use of the service, right? Because obviously, I think most people are saying, well, because it is they're doing this to the white supremacist group and not the protester group, it's acceptable. But obviously, there is a safety concern around no matter who it is, if you're exposing someone's identity and creating this mob mentality around them. So that'll be something that Twitter will have to definitely pay close attention to moving forward.
That's Kurt Wagner, who is senior editor with our partners at Recode. Kurt, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.